Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Owen. Apologies for the podcast being extremely late this week. We recorded this on the 25th of September. So I can only apologise for being so late, but we had a good laugh chatting about Kingsman. I hope you enjoy. Anyway, sorry that the recommendations at the end of the podcast will be somewhat out of date. Cheers.
Welcome to this week's Failed Critics Podcast. I'm Steve Norman. I'm joined this week by Owen Hughes.
Hello.
Brian Plank.
Good evening.
And Tony Black.
How do?
As we take a look at the last week or so in film, including a couple of new releases to review in Kingsman: The Golden Circle and Borg vs. McEnroe. We'll start off with the quiz in a short opening section with no news. I lost the quiz last week, but Owen only gave me the film I had to watch at quite short notice, which was Neon Demon. I haven't watched it yet. I will watch it for next week. Owen, you're hosting the quiz. It's me versus Tony and Brian.
I am, yeah. I'm just going to clarify as well. Neon Demon, I don't dislike that film. I don't think it's a bad film, but I've made you watch it because of your reaction to Mother, which you didn't like because it was too weird and pretentious.
So, it was weird for the sake of weird.
Right. Have fun with Neon Demon.
And pretentious for sake of pretentious. Bit like Holy Motors.
Yeah. Oh, well, you see, Holy Motors is on Film 4 this week. I was tempted to just set that as your task to rewatch it, but I thought you could cheat and just pretend you've rewatched it.
Just remembered.
Yeah. Okay, quiz this week. You need to... I don't know, I think this might be a bit of a tricky one.
Hello, yes, me again. It was quite a tricky one to do because I chose anagrams, which didn't really work out particularly well. They'll be in the podcast description if you wanted to play along. Needless to say, Steve lost. Brian absolutely smashed it. Yeah. And now let's just get on with the rest of the podcast.
Great quiz. Really good quiz. More anagrams next week. Oh, get out your big old word jumble and have a practice. Anagrams. Time for what we've been watching, where we have a look at some of the films we've seen this week outside the cinema, or perhaps even TV shows for this week. Tony, why don't you start us off?
As of like the last 40 minutes from recording, I've just finished watching the first two episodes of Star Trek Discovery, which is the brand new anagrammed a moment ago Star Trek series, which has just dropped on Netflix. It's on the curious CBS All Access in America, and it's a big old con because they're basically making Americans pay for an entirely new streaming service just to watch Star Trek. So
there's a lot of Star Trek geeks out there, isn't there?
Oh yeah, but you know, would you pay like £7 a month extra for on top of Netflix and just for one TV show?
I don't know.
But yeah, there you go.
People who watch Star Wars are cool. People who watch Star Trek are not. If you watch both, I don't know where we stand.
You're allowed to like more than one thing.
You're not. You not if they're kind of the same.
What about people who like Battlestar Galactica? Where do they sit?
You like to like more than two things.
Yeah, somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, Battlestar Galactica's.
What was that?
Is that doing your pod as an anagram of itself? Because it's not going to take on.
I speak in anagrams now.
That was anagram, actually.
Yeah, I speak purely in anagram.
Yeah. But yeah, there's no anagrams on Discovery, which is the it's been a long time coming. This it's it's obviously the first Star Trek series in 12 years. We've had movies, obviously, you know, the very divisive J.J. Abrams movies, but all the Star Trek fandom is just going nuts.
Was Enterprise 12 years ago?
Yeah, well, it finished 12 years ago. Finished in 2005, yeah. So it's been ages, and I think everyone thought it was never going to happen again, and that was it.
Was that the one? Was that the one with the guy from Quantum Leap?
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
It was, yeah. Scott Bakula. Yeah. It was good, to be fair. And it wasn't a terrible show, but it kind of just... It came out at the wrong time. By then, people just didn't care by then. It was losing its way. So it needed a new approach, really. And off the back of the first two episodes... I think they've nailed it, actually, and because there's been a lot of really sort of there's been a lot of production stuff, like Brian Fuller, who did Hannibal and a lot of these other things. He originally came up with the new show, and it was supposed to be an anthology series in different time periods of the Star Trek universe, and then that all changed, and then he quit to do American Gods, which isn't a bad thing because American Gods is brilliant, mental but brilliant. But yeah, it's gone through a lot of trouble. So everyone was a bit like, oh God, is this going to be just a bit of a car crash? Is it just going to be a mess? Thankfully, doesn't seem to be. It's quite interesting because it's set 10 years before the original show in the 60s. And it's got an interesting lead character. She's not only ethnically diverse, like in terms of skin color, because she's black, but she's also ethnically diverse because she's a human, but she was brought up with the Vulcan way. So, you know, if you know anything about Star Trek, you know the Vulcans, Spock and all those guys, they're very emotionless and they speak in very monotone and they restrain their emotions. So she's got a bit of that going on. She's a bit of a woman of two worlds. And she's the first officer. She's not the captain. So the main character isn't the captain for the first time ever. And you've got the Klingons back in a big way, like as the bad guys, you know, because over the years they were softened up with Worf in The Next Generation being all fun, you know, and that kind of thing. And now they're proper antagonists again. They're like fundamentalists. They've really tapped a kind of, you know, Taliban, ISIS kind of vein with these guys, and that they're fundamentalist rebels who are quite determined to go on this holy war, essentially. So you've got that modern kind of commentary going on. But the thing is, what they've done is they've got the feel of it right. Anyone who knows Star Trek, you look for certain things. You look for production design. You look for uniforms. You look for, you know, certain ways in which they film it. And I think it looks a bit more like the Abrams stuff, but it's got the feel of the shows, I think. And so I was really satisfied. And it breezes along quite nicely. And it's serialized. So, you know, the first two have ended up on pretty whopping cliffhangers. And it's not conventional. Like the other shows, it's been ship, crew, different adventure each week, different morality story. This is a proper serialized story. And by the end of episode two, without spoiling anything, it's not a conventional plot. So, yeah, it's a winner. If you're a Star Trek fan, well, if you're a Star Trek fan, you're going to be a pain in the ass because they all are. No offense to anyone who's listening who's a Star Trek fan, but they will hate parts of it. But I think proper Star Trek fans will love it. So give it a try. It's on Netflix. And yeah, it's good. Really good.
Have they done any hand-to-hand fighting in it yet?
Yeah, a little bit.
Have they still got the two-handed punch to the solar plexus and then two hands over the back?
Sadly not
blades?
Yet. I do hope we get that because that's a beautiful, weird Trek thing. The two-handed fist to the back. It's like, glorious.
Guys, we've got fight training, but only for like 20 minutes for the whole next seven seasons. So get this one learned.
Yeah, it's
the job's a good one.
It's the person who does the sort of fighting a stunt double, like slightly podgier, wearing a ill-fitting wig. Is that still a thing in Star Trek?
I think like the main woman, I think her name's Sonequa Martin-Green. I suspect she's probably done her own. And to be fair, Michelle Yeoh's in it. And she gets
she gets
a bit of a fight. So if she didn't do her own stunts, I'll be pretty shocked.
Have we got any nods to other Star Trek things? You know,
well, particularly the films, cool. Right? Because they're still quite new.
Yeah, there's just a lot of visual sort of things. Like, I mean, the guy who did The Wrath of Khan, Nicholas Meyer, is one of the consultants, and you can see a little bit of the kind of design elements he brought into the Star Trek universe, just in certain of the ways in which the technology's presented. There's also things like Spock's dad is in it, which isn't a spoiler, really. It's been something that's been publicised quite well. So that's a very direct reference to a character who's very well known in the Star Trek universe. And there's something in that with that character, which as a big fan made me go, ooh, because it's a massive continuity thing they've managed to tap, I think. But so there's little things, there's a few references. The noises are there, like the whooshing doors and the red alert sirens. So you've got all that stuff. Yeah. I think you can tell it's made by Star Trek fans, which hasn't always been the case with some of these things. I mean, J.J. Abrams is much more of a Star Wars guy, which is why his Star Wars films are better. Well, his Star Wars film is better. Mm. So
it's... 'Cause he came out and said, didn't he, that he wasn't ever for a Star Trek fan.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I really like his first one, you know, and I think that's great, but it's not very Star Trek. It's
a Star Trek film for non-Star Trek fans.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It kind of is, and you know, he was trying to make a bit of a Star Warsy like film with some of those. So he's much more at home doing what he's doing now. But the guys who are making this, you can tell they know their Trek, and I think that comes across in a big way. So if you know, like I said, if you're a big fan of this franchise, I think you're going to really dig this. But then, is it accessible for new people? Ish. My girlfriend has never really sat down and watched the start of a Star Trek series before, and she enjoyed it. So, I mean, that's possibly the barometer. But yeah, every Monday on Netflix. So, boldly go, as they say.
Yes.
I'll give it a go.
Can you guys do the finger thing?
The live long and prosper thing.
Hang on. Just done it. First time ever.
You know, it's your middle and index together and your ring and pinky together.
That is actually meant. I've never been able to do that before. I've just done it for the first time in my life.
There's no video proof.
Can check.
Can you do the Star Trek doors, though? Can you do the...
No.
I can tell you how they do it.
I'm still staring at my hat. I can't believe I've just done that. That's weird. Anyway, Brian, what have you seen this week?
I've been watching a very strange thing called Mr. Biffo's Found Footage. Now, listeners of a certain age, and this might include Brooker, who's not here, when you're in the 90s, one of the main places of video game news in Britain was Digitizer. 10 pages of teletext on Channel 4 that updated relatively regularly. Has anybody else read it?
No.
I've heard of it. I mean, teletext for me was always the football news and scores.
Yeah.
Yeah, 302.
Yeah.
when you come back home from school.
Yeah.
Digitizer was like this cult following thing in that it did video game stuff and then silly stuff. And every... a few pages would be like Mr. T's diary, where Mr. T tells the kids to get away from his bins. It'd be the man daddy, where he makes awful jokes, and you press reveal to get another small joke. Mr. Biffle, he's got an actual name. I don't know his actual name. ended up training to do a whole bunch of things, end up writing children's sitcoms. And from that, he did two things for the CBBC. I think filmed in Northern Ireland, and then got the gig of writing the Pudgy the Dog film, which is, well, you see that, he wrote it, then the editor went, nah, I think we'll cut this, and I'll improvise this, and this for lines, and he went, that's not the film.
I'm sorry, but I can't see the Pudgy the Dog film being vastly different due to what was left on the cutting room floor.
I think the stuff just wasn't filmed rather than stuff that was cut out. But yeah, that's his pedigree. And he's done a thing called Found Footage, which is a set of, I think, 20-minute YouTube videos. The idea is that he went to a car boot sale in 2003, got a bunch of VHS cassettes, and he's found a conspiracy that tells us about the dark side of our reality. It's slightly Black Mirror. It's slightly a sketch show. It's slightly funny. Like, some bits are, this is what a student thinks funny should be or what a student thinks weird should be. But it's not just him. Like, he's got bits with Ian Lee, who used... What was the Channel 4 late night thing Ian Lee used to do? About 15 years ago. Was it the Ian Lee who's now had a radio show? He's in it for a bit. Dave Perry, who used to be a mainstay in the 1990s British TV video game circuit, he's in it for a bit. Danny Wallace is in it.
Wow.
What, the footballer?
No.
Obviously.
He's the yes man, right? And how to start your country, your own country, or whatever it was called. That guy.
He's the one who did the thing about the journey to the centre of the world. Yes. We went to this shit town in Texas. Maybe not Texas. But yeah, it's the entire thing as it exists is a strange concept. The sketches themselves are strange. Like, they start with, if you imagine a telesales guy called Goujon Jean. And Goujon Jean wants you to have some goujons now. And it's this strange TV ad for goujons. Everyone else has gone quiet.
Mm, is it a joke?
Oh, right. No, I'm literally just checking that you're there. Yeah. But yeah, and then they do a bit where it's the Goujon Jean, but he's set up as being like the games master. And there's bits in it that think this is a little bit of word. Now some words just sound funny, or the idea of it is funny. Like, have you seen that list of names of members of the So Solid crew?
Yes.
Yes. I think that Rhyming Douglas is a funny name for someone in So Solid crew. There's a thing called the Roaming Thomas, which, if you're lonely, you have it in your house, and Roaming Thomas will roam around and keep you happy. Bits of it are very weird and think, I don't know why you think this is funny. Bits of it are very dark, and bits of it are actually funny. And it's all just quite unsettling. And I don't know, well, I think it's meant to be unsettling, but maybe not in the way that it actually is. If you've got a spare 2 minutes, have a little look at one of them. There's also a song, an actually good song, about Clive Sinclair, the ballad of Clive Sinclair and what he made after the C5, and what the C6, C7, C8, and C9 were like.
Okay.
My main takeaway is it's tremendously strange. And if you are going, I love Tremendously Strange, check out Mr. Biffo's Found Footage. I think it's an episode comes out every week on Sunday nights for I don't know how long. Apparently we've had episode 4, which is the end of Act 1 of Found Footage.
Cool.
Okay. this week I have been watching a mini-series from last year that was made by the BBC, is now gone to Netflix, which is called Stag. And it is billed as a black comedy. It stars Jim Howick, who you'll probably know as Gerard from Peep Show, or the guy, one of the main guys from Horrible Histories. It also features Tim Keen, James Cosmo, and Reese Shearsmith in much smaller roles. And it's about a group of guys who go on a stag do, obviously hunting in Scotland. And it all goes a bit wrong for them. the main character, which is, as I said, played by Jim Howick, he kind of... So all the other guys on this stag do are all quite laddie, and they've all got, you know, stupid nicknames they've given each other, and they're all kind of quite trying to be alpha and over, you know, hard.
Just lads, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Classic bands.
Yeah. And he's not quite like, he's the stag's future brother-in-law, whose sister has asked him to go along more than anything else to look after him. And they end up... they're obviously in the Scottish wilderness, in the Highlands, and things start going wrong. Some of them start getting killed off, and they don't know who the killer is. There's all kinds of, you know, mystery behind who it is. They come up with different ideas of who it might be. Is the person who's meant to be leading on the hunting party because they've offended him, because they have just been taking the mick out of him? Is it one of the group? Is it just some unknown random mentalist? I've not watched the final episode. There's 3 episodes. I've not watched the final one yet, so I'm still waiting to see who it turns out to be.
Who's your money on at the minute, at this point? because that'd be quite interesting to know. Like, with an episode to go, who do you think?
Have you seen it, Owen, or not?
I saw it last year. Yeah.
I don't think it's anyone obvious at the moment. Uh-huh. I don't think it's anybody who I've seen yet.
Right.
Or if it is, it's quite a minor character who they've not really made too much of. The thing is, with it being billed as a black comedy and there's a lot of comic actors in there, I've not actually found it that funny, but I have kind of found it a good watch. I have kind of liked watching it, seeing how it plays out. I have liked some of the characters and the way they're kind of, taking apart the whole kind of macho, blokey bloke thing. But I've not actually laughed that much at it for something that does have that many comedians in it and is billed as a comedy of sorts. But I do think it's quite well put together, the plotting of it. It does make you want to keep watching to see how it is resolved, although it isn't really the best thing going.
Mm. It was kind of fun at the time, but immediately forgettable.
Yeah.
Again, I think like you've said, the people in it, they're pretty good. Tim Key's always good. Reese Shearsmith's always good. I think it was James Cosmo, wasn't it, who was the gamekeeper?
Yes.
I'm looking, on Wikipedia. James Cosmo is a pretty bloody good actor.
Yeah.
In fact, they're all pretty good actors. Jim Herrick I really like as well. I mean, everything from Yonderland to his little bit, like you said, in Peep Show is just a great comic actor. So
yeah, and Horrible Histories, solid. You could never really fault, really, can you?
Yeah, exactly. It was a solid little series, but... I haven't really got any desire to go back to it. I doubt there'll ever be another one. I don't think I'll make a part two, but I will. I mean, I want you to tell me what your reaction is when you find out who the killer is, though.
Okay.
Because it was I don't know whether I saw it. I don't think I saw it coming, but I think it was just a bit like. I'm not going to say anymore in case it gives it away. But
Well, I'll tweet you tomorrow when I probably get around to watching the final episode.
Mm.
So that's available on Netflix now. Owen, what have you seen this week?
I watched a cult horror film from 1979 called Phantasm. It's written and directed by Don Coscarelli, who is basically known for the Phantasm film series, but he also did John Dies at the End, which was kind of fun, a bit weird. He did The Beastmaster, which is another cult film. And he also did Bubba Hotep, which is a film about an elderly Elvis Presley fighting mummies in an old people's home.
Yeah, that was different, wasn't it?
That was a bit odd. Yeah, mm-hmm. Bruce Campbell in that is just quality. So Phantasm is American. It's an American cult horror film, but feels very much like watching a Euro horror from that era, something maybe that came out of Italy. It came out right at the end of the 70s. Like I said, it was 1979. So it's just got that whole vibe about it. I think it was heavily influenced by some of the giallo horrors from the era. It's about a 13-year-old boy called Mike, who's played by an actor called A. Michael Baldwin. And that's how he's credited, A. Michael Baldwin. But he's not the Mike Baldwin from Corrie. Mike Baldwin, to clarify. Anyway, Mike and his older brother, Jody, who's played by Bill Thornbury, they become the target of a weird, somewhat supernatural grave robber called the Tall Man, who looks a bit like Max Wall. So if you've ever seen the video for Vindaloo by Fat Les, you know the guy who's in the bald cap, got the long hair at the sides and the tuxedo, runs around bobbing his head about?
Yeah.
That's a bit like what the Tall Man looks like in this.
Right.
Yes. And the Tall Man is
Very intimidating.
Well, he is very intimidating in this. He's also ably assisted by his army of zombie dwarves. It looks...
If you were going to pick a zombie army...
Yeah.
And you were going to specify a body type, you wouldn't go for dwarf, would you?
Well, these are the people... He robs the graves and all the people that are in the town where he is, somewhere in Oregon, they are turned into dwarfs when they come back as zombies. But It's not really explained either. But anyway, so it looks even weirder than it sounds as well. Because the actor who's playing the tall man, who's called Angus Scrimm, he was about 6'4". He wore a suit that was too small and had platform shoes. So he looks fucking massive anyway. Basically, he's like Christopher Lee massive. That's what he looks like in this. He's a really big, tall, skinny, intimidating looking fella. If he didn't remind you of the guy from the Fat Les music video. So it's a proper cult horror. It was made for not very much money, but grossed a lot of money. I think that's kind of the definition. And it's got since gone on to become this sort of hit with horror fans. There are some really lovely shots in it. It's very atmospheric. It has terrible acting in it. I mean, some of it is just embarrassing, but and large portions of it don't make sense. For example, like the dwarves. Why are they dwarves? I don't know. The woman in it who lures blokes back to the graveyard to shag them, but then stabs them afterwards. And the blind, mute, psychic grandma neighbour. And just all of it, just like, what are they doing in this film? What is the point of them other than to be a bit kind of nightmarish? It's all a bit weird. However, this wasn't the first time that I've seen Phantasm. I watched it back in 2012 and was mildly underwhelmed by it at the time, which is kind of sacrilegious to say out loud because it's such a favourite for a lot of people. And this time too, it didn't have that much impact on me, but I did like it more. And I think the reason I liked it more, and the reason I rewatched it, to be honest, was because all of the Phantasm movies have been added to Shudder recently. Because they've been restored by J.J. Abrams and his production company Bad Robot. And they've all been restored to 4K quality. They were originally shown at a film festival in 2016 when they were redone, and the reaction was very positive. I only found out about this like when I noticed they were added to Shudder. It's not like I've been following it, but actually it convinced me enough to go and watch it again. And it honestly, it just looks incredible. They've really done a great job at making it this sort of HD, properly modern-looking horror. It's great. I always remembered it as looking kind of cheap as well, but it in this high quality, it just doesn't look that cheap. Sometimes when these older films are restored, you tend to notice some of the lamer, cheaper-looking effects, but I don't think it really mattered so much in this one. It streamed really well through Shudder as well, so that's always a bonus because sometimes Shudder's a bit iffy. And I know I end up plugging Shudder a lot, despite not really having any special discount codes to hand out to listeners. You can't go to Shudder/failcritics and get a discount. But they really do have some classic films on there, and it's basically a Netflix of horror films. And I wouldn't have bothered ever watching Phantasm again if it weren't for Shudder adding this restored version to its streaming service. So, I mean, I'd recommend people give it a go, particularly if you are into sort of your cult horrors and haven't seen it yet. And then, yeah, if you wanted to, you could check out I think there's 5 sequels in total, and they're all there waiting for you.
That wasn't a subtle hint, was it, when you were talking about discount code?
No. Do you think I should try? I'm going to try. I'm going to say...
Well, no, just in case people thought you were like subtly hinting, if you went to Shudder and typed in fail critics, you wouldn't get anything.
Type in fail critics when prompted to do so, and you'll get fuck all.
Yeah. Okay. That's so that's all on Shudder, which is like a horror version of Netflix, is it?
Exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's owned by Sony, but it's not an independent little thing. But yeah, I mean, for what it does for horror films, there's some... every other week now I'm watching stuff on there, and then it's seemingly reviewing it on the podcast. So yeah,
cool.
I like it.
Two new releases for us to review this week. First of all, is the film that only Tony has seen, which is the new Borg versus McEnroe film.
Is this another Star Trek one?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Borg versus John McEnroe. I'd watch that, actually. I think that'd be amazing.
It'd be very, very short.
You cannot be serious about assimilating. Yeah, anyway. But no.
I wondered how long it would take to do a you cannot be serious joke.
Well, it is in the film.
All I can say is that I was upset that it wasn't me.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, Steve. Sorry. But it is in the film. You do get the you cannot be serious moment in Borg versus McEnroe, which is about Borg and McEnroe. Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe, the two of the biggest names in tennis ever. Tennis isn't one of those, it's not one of those sports that gets a lot of love with cinema. Although, ironically, we've got two tennis films out in the next, 3 months. We've got Battle of the Sexes with Emma Stone and Steve Carell in a couple of months, so which looks like a very different film. But it's this, obviously, in the grand tradition of most good sports films, this isn't really about tennis. It's more about the psychology of these two guys. So you've got Bjorn Borg, 4 times Wimbledon world champion in a row, and he's top dog. This is 1980. He's top dog. And John McEnroe's the angry young upstart. And the difference is McEnroe is, as we know, McEnroe's barking, which is why he's played by Shia LaBeouf, because Shia LaBeouf is really good in this because he plays himself effectively. So he's like really angry and wants the title and everything. He's got a lot to prove. And then Ben Borg is this vision of cool. You know, he's called a machine. You know, he's just got that Swedish efficiency to him. But while McEnroe is trying to prove himself and he's angry that people want to talk more about his reputation than his tennis, Borg, he's struggling with fame. He's struggling with the pressure of hitting the 5 times world champion title, which would put him in the record books forever. So it tells that story. So it's set during the finals, the Wimbledon finals in 1980. And it does that traditional sort of sports thing. It starts with a little bit of the match and then goes back to like a week before and tells the story of how they got there. And then there are flashbacks to when they're both kids and the story of how they both, you know, became involved in tennis and, you know, how Borg was more like McEnroe when he was a kid, funnily enough, and then he learned to channel that. But it's good, you know, it's really well put together, I thought. I thought it was two great performances. The guy who plays Borg is called Sverre Gudnason, I think his name is. And he's good at that sort of restrained level, whereas LaBeouf is all, you know, swearing, anger, energy. And they complement each other really well. You know, it's pretty well shot. It's it doesn't feel like it drags. And the final tennis match is really well put together. Because that match, I mean, this was before I was born, so I don't remember it. But it was an electrifying match by all accounts. They said, when I was looking at it, actually, when I was reviewing it, it was the match wasn't equaled in tennis terms until Federer and Nadal in 2008. For like nearly 30 years, people considered that to be the greatest tennis match ever played. And it was an epic. And I won't tell you who wins it, but because I didn't know. I didn't know who won it, actually. I didn't know the ending, which made it more interesting, actually, to watch.
It's great watching sport films like that. I had that watching Rush.
I was thinking exactly the same thing. Yeah.
I don't know how this goes, and I don't know who I want to win.
Yeah.
This sound kind of similar to Rush in so much as it's about two very, very top level sports stars within their sport who have got very different, not just personalities, but methods of, you know, they're different ways and different reasons for, you know, doing the sport that they do.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is, and it's psychological as well. You know, it's about the strain on their mental health in different ways in order to be the best, you know, in order to be the top of their game. So it's biography by way of, you know, one of those sports films where, you see, he's not really an underdog you root for, McEnroe, because he's a bit of a twat. But at the same time, he's not loathsome in it, and you can understand it's more about Borg really than McEnroe, but you understand his journey as well. You know, and by the end, you actually quite like both of them. So that kind of makes, you know, the journey by the time you get to that final even more interesting. I really liked it. I really liked it, especially come off the back of Kingsman, which I didn't like particularly, but that's for later. But like it was good. It was good. I recommend it. Even if you don't love tennis or you don't know much about tennis, you don't really have to. I'm a casual tennis watcher. And I, like I say, I didn't know the ending of this. I didn't know the result. And I was pretty hooked. So it's a good one. It's a good sports one.
Yeah, Kingsman. Not too much later because we're doing that now. Kingsman, the golden Kingsman, the Golden Circle, the sequel to the 2014 surprise hit, and we see Taron Egerton and Mark Strong and Colin Firth. That's not a secret. It's in the trailer. Come back as the Kingsman. Undergo a bit of turmoil at the hands of a new villain played by Julianne Moore, and they have to join up with their American counterparts, the Statesmen. What did we all think of the film? I thought it was fine. The major problems with it being is that it wasn't anything surprising. It wasn't anything new, and it wasn't anything that was different and took you by surprise in so much as the first one. The action film, the action scenes were all really well done, and they looked cool, and they looked stylish, and they looked fun. And then, obviously, in the first one, you had Colin Firth, who no one really thought could be an action star, was actually really good in that role. And in this second one, you've got all of that, but it's not a surprise anymore. So it was just okay for me.
I thought pretty much that. I mean, I didn't watch any of the trailers on the grounds that I'm going to see the film. I don't need you to sell it to me. So I didn't... I had seen posters that Colin Firth was back, but I didn't go in knowing any story beats. I thought from the one poster I saw that the Golden Circle was about this lasso that someone had on the hip. Right, Golden Circle, Statesman, got it, sorted. But yeah, the first one, it wasn't just it looks cool. I hadn't seen anything like the church scene before. It seemed like genuinely innovative cinematic violence that was slightly thrilling, whereas this one, it felt a bit like Pirates of the Caribbean 2. They sat down and said, what worked with number one? We'll do that, but we'll turn it up to 11. And it's like, but I've already seen lots of that stuff. The exciting thing to do would be to try something new instead of do the same thing but more.
I mean, some scenes were almost exactly the same. They just almost did the exact same thing again, hoping for better results. And it just felt a bit lazy, I think, is the issue.
It's a film that's very conscious that it's a sequel.
Yeah.
And you probably could watch the first... You could watch the second one on its own and be, right, that's fine, it explains everything for you. But it does depend on getting impact from you having seen the first one.
I don't know.
Because it leans on it all the time.
I don't know really what original they could have done, though. I mean...
But the plot was almost the same, right?
You can think of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because the first one had the phone was going to be... The SIM cards were the ones that were basically going to make everyone...
Yeah.
Supremely violent and kill each other. And you go, okay, well, in this one, what's the difference? Well, it's drugs. Drugs, people who are smoking drugs are all going to die.
Yeah.
It's the exact same hostage kind of situation going on.
Yes.
And there was just less of the villain.
I mean, Samuel L. Jackson wasn't in it a huge amount in the first one. But he was kind of interesting, whereas Julianne Moore had one characteristic.
There seemed to be more to Samuel L. Jackson's character. There seemed to be a bit more to that villain.
Whereas Poppy was just... I mean, it's kind of funny the first time and you thought, okay, she's making... Because the first time you see her is when the two goons...
Keith Allen.
Yeah.
And that was quite a good scene. I quite enjoyed that bit. And then it didn't really go anywhere from there. It was just a bit of a shame, really. Whereas, you know, with Samuel L. Jackson, it was quite interesting to see him each time he was on screen.
Yeah, I did like the henchman coming back from the first film, Charlie. I thought that was quite good, and I thought he was quite good as kind of a antagonist.
Yeah, and it was actually Taron Egerton and Mark Strong were both good. They're both reliable.
Yeah, I thought Mark Strong was probably of the good guys, the better of the three in this one.
He has one of the best jokes. More. He has one of the best jokes though, with the when they finish off the bottle of Kentucky.
Yeah,
and they're both super pissed.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to go to Kentucky.
Yeah.
Oh, I love fried chicken.
That wasn't that great.
You didn't like that? Well, it was quite funny.
Yeah, I just thought it's nothing original now. So the wow factor of the first one, the two or three things that made you, you know, like Colin Firth being this action star with all the, you know, the church scene and the pub scene and everything in a photo. You know, wow, that's the guy from The King's Speech. He should be...
That's a quality film.
Yeah.
The King's Speech is ace.
No, but you know what I mean? You're looking at it and he's doing that and you think, he should be crap at this. He's never done anything like this.
Do you know what I think the problem is with it? One of the big problems, and I'm giving you a shameless plug here, but I'm giving you an insight into an article that I'm writing about this that's coming out tomorrow on setthetape.com, which...
Never heard of it,
website. But I think part of the problem is it's got nothing to say. The first film was about culture in many ways. It was about the class divide. It was about Eggsy being essentially like, you know, an urban chav, for want of a better word, who then is, you know, risen up. Matthew Vaughan loved the fact that he was able to take a chav and make him into, you know, Colin Firth, into an establishment figure. He hates the establishment. He's always happy to stick one finger up at all that. And that's what Kingsman was. It was a cheeky little fuck you to that kind of thing, while also embracing it at the same time, which is why Colin Firth was so badass. But the problem with this is that there's nothing going on there. That had a very interesting story arc and it had some commentary on British culture and things like that. Statesman is a gimmick. And it's a gimmick. It's a one-joke gimmick that doesn't last very long either. Jeff Bridges is simply there to just go, yee-haw, and that kind of thing. Channing Tatum's wasted. Like, he's barely in it. And it just feels like you're not saying anything about that stereotype. You know, at least with... You know, Colin Firth and the Kingsman, you're tapping into things like, you know, old James Bond, the Avengers, that kind of, you know, upper class comportment, manners, that kind of thing. With the Americans, it's just to get people dressed in chaps, flinging whips. You know, there's nothing there. And that, and all the way through, I was thinking, yeah, okay, this is fun. It is fun. You know, some of the sequences were fine. I like Taron Egerton. I like you guys. I like Mark Strong, although, spoilers, what they do with him at the end, I just was like, oh, fuck off. No. It was hollow. It was hollow. And it was repetitious, like you guys have said. The story's exactly the same. Julianne Moore's a watered down Sam Jackson. And by the end, I was just like, that was just flabby. It was bloated. And it was exactly what you don't do with a sequel if you want to create something genuinely interesting.
And the things that it tried to do that were interesting, they never really followed up on. So with the villain, with Samuel L. Jackson in the first film, his main thing was, you know, everybody obsessed with both celebrity and their, and like, you know, being connected to the internet, having their mobile phone. In this one, obviously the big thing is the main villain is you know, a drug cartel leader, a basically big time drug dealer. And the president in that, there's a whole thing about legalizing drugs, which is an interesting concept to touch on, except they just touch on it and don't do anything more with it. And also then there's the other, it's kind of more interesting thing with regards to the plot, is Eggsy's character being in his job as kind of, a spy, having to... sleep with a target or an enemy, but also being in a relationship, and they touch on that element of it, and then don't really do anything with that either.
But that was that.
They touched on that element.
Very good.
Well,
that was fucking uncomfortable.
That was the point, though, wasn't it? Right, that was what that's exactly what Matthew Vaughan wanted people to feel like. This is awkward. Like, look at what it is. He's kind of molesting her in a way because he's doing it for nefarious purposes, right? He's trying to implant a device in her.
Come on, we're talking about a bit of fingering.
Yeah,
quick
yeah.
Question, but, though. It's like quick question. Yeah. Who here watched it with their dad?
Oh,
no, I didn't.
No.
And watched the first one with their dad, because that's what we do now. My dad and I go out to see Kingsman films. Like, the release date, dad, we're going out.
Awkward.
The anal joke at the start was like, oh my God. And they know it's one that's made everyone go, ah.
so they keep on referring to
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Which is good. Like, I'm happy.
Can I get tickets if I say the world? You can get backstage passes. We all know you mean that's
fine. Mm. Talking of that, what do we think about Elton John
well,
in
just,
this?
Just before you do that, I mean, on that sex scene, though, you know the actress who was playing Clara? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Taron Egerton wouldn't do that scene. He didn't want to do it. So they had to get her husband in to play Taron Egerton to do the fingering bit.
You know what's funny with that? You should say that, Owen, because he was on Kermode and Mayo, and I don't know if any of you listened to that, but he was on that. And then afterwards, he was asked about that by Simon Mayo, and he kind of skirted around whether or not, you know, he thought that it was, you know, a good thing to sort of replay the same kind of gross-out sex gag that the first film had. And Kermode makes the point. He says, I think, reading between the lines, Taron Egerton didn't like it, and he didn't like it in the first one either. And so it's funny you should say that because, yeah, there's a feeling like it's probably one of the things that he wasn't on board with because it does feel like it's. I know what they're trying to. I know what he's trying to do, Matthew Vaughan, but it kind of just.
He's saying, look, think about it when James Bond does it. That's what he's saying.
He is.
Think about it when James Bond just shags the target.
I think it worked better in the first one because you kind of. At the end of every Bond film, he always ends up shacking up with some bird. Right, and he's obviously going to do stuff like that to her. And that film was a bit more on the nose. But this one, I don't know. I am no prude at all, but I just found it was just a bit icky, you know. And
But that's the point, because
it's like it's punishing the audience. Like, you wanted a sex bit? Here's a sex scene for you. Are you not enjoying the sexy bit?
Again, it was one of the things I quite liked about the film is that it would do that.
It's definitely something I haven't seen elsewhere, and that's it has at least that thing going for it. And considering the amount of dismemberment and mutilation that we get in all the violence bits, the fact that this is what makes people uncomfortable, and they really push it, I think has to have some sort of points for it. I also, you talked about class, we can get off fingering for a minute. I found that the start of the first film, that had kind of an uncomfortable feel about class. Mm-hmm. It was kind of sneery. Like, if you see the bit from his mum, from when his dad gets killed to, like, 15 years later when she's getting implied to be double-teamed by her new bloke and his mate, and it's all a bit sordid, and it's like, chavs, I'm doing fingers at them, like, chavs, what are they like? And it still has that slightly uncomfortable bit. And I know for Eggsy it is because they do lots of like code switching and where he's in his suit and he's being all presentable. Then he's lounging around in his Adidas because it's Adidas. You spotted it's Adidas. And he's running out in his like track suits and baseball caps. And it could have a thing to say about code switching to go from Chav to Posh Taylor and then to go that same thing from Posh Taylor to royalty. I don't know if it doesn't make that point again because it'd just be rehashing. Or if it because it hasn't doesn't want but to labour it, but there's an element.
There's
of
too
it.
Much going on. Like in this film, there's just so many things that they're trying to do. There's Colin Firth coming back. There's, you know, the Kingsman being destroyed, and then off in one of the really good characters in the first film, like in 5 minutes, which is a real shame. The woman Roxy, you know, you've got the Statesman, you've got Poppy the villain, you've got Mark Strong. There's just too much. So like you said, and you can't do all that. Is it interesting?
The best person in it who you neglected to mention there, Elton John. At first, again, like this was, we were talking earlier about the things that are wrong with some sequels. And it's usually one of those things that's wrong with it is celebrity cameo. And as soon as he was in it, I thought, oh, here we go, celebrity cameo. But actually, he got quite a bit to do. And I mean, he's a terrible actor, but the character was funny.
It did work, I think, the joke, yeah.
He was willing to laugh at himself, which is...
It's the bit where he sat down in the room in the little cubicle and he's like, get the fuck out of my room.
I didn't mind him. Yeah. I think if it was someone else, it would have been massively obnoxious.
Yeah, the wrong celebrity in that role would have not...
It worked better than it had any right to.
He had more screen time than I expected and the bit with the flying kick and the platforms was like...
Yeah, that was a bit cringe.
Yeah.
But I think it was just about enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they've obviously teed it up for a third film. Whether they'll make one or not, I don't know. I imagine it'll do quite well at the box office. And if the people are willing to return,
I don't want to watch Golden Circle twice, but I would want to watch a sequel to it.
If they, yeah, I'd watch a sequel to it in the hope that they would do something different with the series or try and be a bit more original, or I don't really know what they can do, but that's not
well,
my job.
They're talking about doing a Statesman spin-off, apparently, which presumably would front load Channing Tatum, you'd imagine, the, you know, and Halle Berry.
Even though he's just during the
season. Even though by the end. So maybe they'll do that. I think they will do a third one, but I don't think the I don't think people will be as excited about it now, to be quite honest. Because
there's more of a chance of a Kingsman 3 than there is a Kick-Ass 3. Put it that way. You know.
Well, that's because Kingsman 2 was better than Kick-Ass 2.
And there's also a third Kingsman series being written.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Red Diamond, I think. It's coming out just now.
Well, that's almost all for the podcast this week. We're going to go for some recommendations before we send you on your way, though. I am going to go for something I've not even seen, but I'm going to watch it. I'm going for, if you're bored on a Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock, if you go to the Horror Channel, there is a film from 2014 called Icetastrophe. Right, and if you read the overview for this film, actually the thing I like is there's no recognisable names in it, so when you're looking down the cast list, I don't know which is the character's name and which is the actor's name. So is Charlie Ratchet the character or the actor? Is Crystal Krug the character, or is it Johanna Newmarch? I don't know.
That's next week's quiz. That's next week's quiz. All sorted.
Yeah,
The only one that
I know is definitely a character is Mayor Gibbons, because Ben Cotton is not a character over Mayor Gibbons. Mayor is not someone's first name. It might be. Anyway, the overview for the film is two feuding families face a battle for survival at Christmas. A meteor crashes to Earth in the middle of their small hometown and unleashes a wave of ice crystals that freezes everything it touches with deadly consequences for anyone caught in its path.
Seems a bit like that name disaster movie that I keep seeing trailer.
That Gerard Butler one.
I am all over Geostorm.
Yeah.
That looks fucking awful.
Terrible.
Looks great.
I will like Geostorm. I don't care who knows it. And if anyone thinks me any less, I will go and watch it. I will enjoy it. And I don't care who knows it.
The only thing that I liked about the Geostorm trailer was I could lean over to my dad and say, I worked with his cousin. it just looks utter pomp.
Mm-hmm. No, it's going to be great.
It is going to be great. It's going to be stupid.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great fun.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
The science will be all neutrinos mutating everywhere. And it's going to be great fun. And some landmarks will get destroyed. Mm.
Definitely.
We'll definitely see at least a hat trick of landmarks being destroyed.
it's been produced and directed by the guy who produced the Stargate film, Independence Day,
yes.
Godzilla from 1998,
no.
Eight-Legged Freaks. That's the quality we're in for.
Yeah, I'm sold.
And
you didn't need to tell me that before. I was already sold.
So is Eight-Legged Freaks his last big film?
I'm having a look through. Cellular, I don't know what that is.
Is that not a lone woman murder thriller story?
With Kim Basinger.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah.
And Chris Evans and Jason Statham.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's not. It's got a good cast, weirdly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's done some librarian films? Like TV movies?
Oh, The Librarian. Is that The Librarian?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Is that the American TV series with Noah Wiley?
I think it is.
It is the Librarian TV series. He was an executive producer.
Mm. I have not.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is, just that it exists and it looks weird.
Mm. Well, anyway, that's Icetastrophe, and more on that next week.
Is that going to be your what we've been watching next week?
Yeah. Unless I see something better than that, it's going to be Icetastrophe.
I doubt you will.
Yeah.
Unless there's something better than
I might just watch a lot of bad disaster films on the Horror Channel this week. Like these really stupid science ones. Owen, what are you going to watch?
I'm also recommending a film that I haven't seen. But it's the third episode in a row that... I think it's the third episode in a row that the new Korean revenge thriller the villainess has been mentioned. But I'm going to give it a plug as well now by saying it's available to rent on Google Play, iTunes, Amazon Video, and so on. It's about an assassin who's forced to confront a couple of blokes from her past who threaten to reveal some dark secrets of hers, apparently. That's what I read in the plot synopsis. I've not watched it yet, but Sean on Twitter, at SugDaddy, he pointed out that it's now available to rent. And as I think we had Brooker review, Brooker and Mike loved it, I think, from the Fright Fest pod. Paul talked about it last week.
It's great. I've seen it as well. It's
and you've seen it?
It's really good. Yeah, it's great.
There we go. Yeah. So it's just finished. It's running UK cinemas, pretty much. It's a little bit expensive to rent. Because usually they're about like £3.50, but this one's about £6 to £7, I think I've seen it. But it's not too bad considering it was only in cinemas like last week. So, yeah, The Villainess is on most video on demand services.
Okay, Brian?
I went through the new on iPlayer list, and one thing jumped out. I mean, again, I haven't seen this one, but with a title like The Gap Year Pedophile, I'm at least intrigued. It's literally about a 30-year-old who was arrested after 10 years of molesting kids in Malaysia. And, well, it
the title definitely beats Icetastrophe.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm now imagining a thing where two warring families get together for a big dinner and then a paedophile crashes into the town with consequences.
What kind of crystals does the pit know?
No.
Let's not. We're going to go full brass eye in a minute.
Yeah. Tony, what are you going to tell people to watch?
Shh. Silence. Yeah. Silence. Which is not me telling you to shut up. Mm-hmm. It's Martin Scorsese's film that's just come on Amazon Prime. If anyone's got that. Which is an acquired taste. I quite enjoyed it. It's about like two Christian missionaries in like the 17th century.
It's really good.
Who go?
It's very good.
Yeah, they go to Japan to look for their mentor, played by Liam Neeson. And yeah, it's long. It's long, but it's beautifully shot. And it is very good. It's got some great performances. Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver. Although I always felt like they were playing the wrong parts. They should have swapped. That's all the way through. I was thinking, why aren't they playing the other parts? But it's good.
Are you thinking we should have a face off?
Yeah.
With them.
Face off meets silence. or silence with John Travolta and Nicolas Cage. Now that would be amazing, actually. I'd watch
that. Nicolas Cage would just fucking nail that role.
Yeah. But it is very good, but it's you've got to be in the right mood and put it on at the right time because it's long. But it's different from a lot of what Scorsese normally does, and that's not saying what he normally does isn't good, because obviously it is. But it's one that not everyone has seen either, so give it a try.
Well, it is similar to some of his other, because it's very much about Catholicism, and you know that's what's prevalent through a lot of his other films.
But in terms of like the location and the, I suppose that he did Kundun, didn't he? Which is, I suppose, not exactly the same, but where he was tapping that's sort of same area. But I mean, like, it's not like gangsters in New York and things like that. Do you know what I mean? No. It's not Wolf of Wall Street kind of stuff, which people might. Mm. Goodfellas, you know, people might automatically go there with Scorsese, but yeah, it's very different from that.
Yeah.
Okay, so yes, that is all for this week's Failed Critics podcast. Thank you all for listening.
The Failed Critics podcast is presented by Steve Norman and Owen Hughes, with contributions from different guests every week, with original music provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com from the track The Bandit, remixed by James Yule, who you can find at jamesyule.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Failed Critics, on iTunes and all good podcast apps, or you can check us out at failedcritics.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave a rating or a review. And why not check out our sister podcasts, Character Unlock and Field and Mullinger's Underground Nights, from the Failed Media Network of podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.